The other thing is that never has it been easier to start a startup and fail at a startup and still not like have that be a setback in your career. It kind of just helps you kind of move up in your career. So I would say go take that risk, go give it a shot, right? Because if you have a really great idea, sometimes that naivete, right, like not knowing all the specifics about an industry, that ends up being a benefit and a boost. So I encourage it. I think it's a good idea. Now, do I think that every single startup that's coming out in that mold is going to make it? No, the majority are not, right? Like, no, go into it knowing that fact. But I think it will help you advance personally and professionally. And you know, if those companies don't work out and those individuals want to still continue that startup journey, you know, those are the ones we try to hire, right? Like, we try to find people that have maybe took their stab and maybe didn't kind of make it, but they have the absolutely the right DNA, and we want to go and hire those individuals to kind of join our journey there.
You're listening to Zero to One, the podcast where future unicorns get a start. Every week, we sit down with the founders actually building, the ones turning scrappy ideas into real-world companies. No fluff, no cliches, just raw insights, hard lessons, and the playbooks that VCs and top operators don't share publicly. We're your hosts, Jonathan, Matteo, and Gary. Three friends obsessed with turning zero into one. Ready to build something legendary? Let's dive in.
So today on Zero to One, we are joined by Ankur Patel, founder and CEO of Multimodal, the startup behind Agentflow, an agentic AI platform purpose-built to automate complex workflows in finance and insurance. Before Multimodal, Ankur built AI and data products across finance and enterprise, from founding Glean, a spend intelligence startup, to leading machine learning and data science teams at firms serving global banks and Fortune 500s. Today, we'll unpack how that journey led to Agentflow and what it takes to bring AI into production at scale, especially in high-stakes, regulated environments. So welcome, Ankur, to Zero to One. How are you today?
I'm doing great. I appreciate being on the show. So thanks for having me.
Thanks for coming. You know, can you maybe first introduce yourself to our listeners who may not know you yet?
Yeah, I mean, I think you did a great backdrop on me. You know, I think for me, this is my third startup. I've been doing machine learning and AI now for 10 years. But a lot of my background comes from finance. So having been an industry insider at JP Morgan and being a bond trader at Bridgewater, which is a big macro hedge fund, world's largest fund there. And I have a lot of experience as an operator, but the last 10 years I've been building machine learning products and AI products to go and sell into that segment, right? So finance as well as insurance. This is just a big inflection point when it comes to technology, right? So you have AI, particularly agentic AI, that is going to change how we all do work within finance and insurance. And so we're building product, building a company in that category today.
Really cool. Ankur, you have a very rich background and in very various experiences. From finance, you started JP, then you went to Bridgewater, then you started a hedge fund before going to tech a couple of years ago, a little less than a decade ago, I think. How did that shape your, let's say, AI background? And do you think that it was a great idea? Would you start over going to tech today with working in finance a bit or working for larger, let's say, more processed enterprises before starting a company? Or would you just go all in today on AI and drop out of college?
Hey, that's a very good question. Very good question. I mean, I think, you know, when I graduated college, technology, particularly startups, weren't quite in vogue and mainstream as they are today. I graduated 2009 from college. And so at that time, I think the conventional wisdom was you want to start your career in finance or consulting, right? Or you want to go to grad school. And in some ways, there's like a recursive algorithm in place in college, which is you as a undergraduate do what the undergraduate classes before you did, right? And so like if the classes before you went to finance, you have a stronger kind of inclination to go into finance. And it takes time for that machinery to change. But I think for me, when I went into finance at JP Morgan coming out of the global financial crisis and then Bridgewater afterwards, what was clear was that the decision-making process involved a lot of data, right? So we didn't call it AI back then. We didn't even call it machine learning, Even data science as a term was just starting to emerge, but it was doing deep data analysis, not in spreadsheets like CSVs, but maybe using business intelligence software like a Spotfire as an example, right? Or Domo or one of these players looking and analyzing data. And so I think for me, kind of the introduction to all of this space happened slowly. It was like, let's get good data science, let's analyze data, let's get data engineering done. One thing after another, you started seeing the early forms of machine learning that became viable, like Stanford NLP, NLTK, right? These libraries to analyze natural language. And then of course, when you kind of fast forward, then you saw full-blown machine learning as a space emerge, and then machine learning, especially after large language models, became relabeled as AI. But I think today, I think my advice is computer science and programming still deeply valuable. But if you could couple that with deep expertise in a particular vertical, like let's say finance, that marriage between industry knowledge and software is a really, really important juncture, right? And so I recommend having your hat both on the operator side and as a programmer. I think that's really rich.
What do you think of all those youngsters launching companies straight out of college to disrupt insurance or finance or the finance space? Because you mentioned, you know, like the importance of having industry knowledge. And what I see on my end is that a lot of people are launching startups in spaces where they don't have prior industry knowledge. So what do you think of this strategy for our listeners listening and who might be asking themselves, you know, like, should I disrupt this space or are there too much barriers to entry?
Well, first I want to say I absolutely love that category of individuals that basically drop out of college or graduate, let's say, and then immediately do something that's entrepreneurial, right? Like those are the individuals that they don't necessarily have to kind of follow conventional paths. They think independently. They love to build. They work hard. I love that type. That's the mold that we try to hire at Multimodal. So for us, like I think finding those individuals to kind of join our journey is very, very important. We do that. But I think to speak on specifically on that strategy, you know, I think we're at this point around AI that is important to recognize, which is AI in its present form is just starting out. And what I mean by that is like no one has like decade of experience just using large language models. So because the technology is so new, it levels a playing field between people that have 10, 15, 20 years of experience and the ones that are just graduating. So that's really great. The second thing is that we're in that part of the hype cycle where capital is a little bit easier to come by. And also the barriers for building software have come down as well because you have things like vibe coding and agentic coding. And so I think that is really important to consider. The other thing is that never has it been easier to start a startup and fail at a startup and still not have that be a setback in your career. It kind of just helps you kind of move up in your career. So I would say, go take that risk. Go give it a shot, right? Because if you have a really great idea, sometimes that naivete, right? Like not knowing all the specifics about an industry, that ends up being a benefit and a boost. So I encourage it. I think it's a good idea. Now, do I think that every single startup that's coming out in that mold is going to make it? No, the majority are not, right? Like go into it knowing that fact. But I think it will help you advance personally and professionally. And, you know, if those companies don't work out and those individuals want to still continue that startup journey, those are the ones we try to hire, right? Like we try to find people that have maybe took their stab and maybe didn't kind of make it, but they have absolutely the right DNA. And we want to go and hire those individuals to kind of join our journey there.
Yeah, that's something we see also. I mean, in Europe, in France, and most of the unicorns are basically people that had no experience in the field. Look at Doctolib, which is the largest healthcare, let's say, appointment booking for healthcare in France, that they have like about 80% of the market. The founders had no clue and they just went out of high school, of uni, of school, and business school, and just launched this newer revolution, which is now a unicorn in France. But what's, maybe go back to Multimodal, what's like the promise behind launching Multimodal? How did you come up with it? Quite early in the AI agent space, before we called them AI agents, like 2.5 years ago, as well as me. I mean, knowing that now everyone like seems to talk about agents, but 2.5 years ago, 3 years ago, it wasn't maybe as evident as it is today.
Yeah, I think my journey, especially like with the experience I have, I came into all of this as an insider, both insider in finance and an insider in AI and machine learning, right? I've written 3 books in this space. At the time, right before I started Multimodal, I was writing a book alongside NVIDIA, right? And speaking about how to get adoption around large language models and enterprise. And so I think for me, I saw from my previous startup, Glean AI, around analyzing invoices, informing CFOs around spend that they had and helping them manage spend better. I think that led me to basically Multimodal, which is, can we take the same technology and start doing work that normally people do, right? So having AI take actions in the same ways that people do, but in the background. And at the time, like, we didn't realize this was going to be such a buzzy term, like AI agents and agentic AI. Although for us, like, you know, we set out with like AI agents in mind. It's a term that we used two and a half years ago when we first started, and it wasn't a popular term. It, you know, it was a kind of like a lightly used term. Same thing with multimodal. When we founded the company, multimodal wasn't as common, right? When we landed on it. So I think we were early on in having the right kind of vision around some of these ideas. But our premise is the following. I think there are 2 types of AI that you should consider today. There is assistive AI that's going to augment human intelligence. And most of that's happening through search and chat. So think like ChatGPT, but at work. And we think that that can add some value that is helpful. But the bulk of the value will actually happen from what I'd call more autonomous background agents, right? So think of these as like agentic AI agents, or AI that is built to have agency around how work gets done. And they're working in the background doing work that normally people would do. And now they can operate for long swaths of time and do complex parts of the process that normally people would have had to do. And that's massively value creating, right? Because now all of a sudden it's doing what human labor would have otherwise had to do. And so it's not just assisting, but it's actually doing the work directly as well.
I'm sure you know the keyword multimodal might be very expensive today.
Yeah.
Yeah. But back to this, you know, very interesting technology. What can we do with agentic AI that we couldn't do before, and especially with regards to finance and insurance context? Like, why is this all of a sudden ability to interact with tools, like to see agents able to interact with tools? Why is it a game changer, especially right now in the industry?
Yeah, so I think if you look at the last 10, even 20 years, you had SaaS, right? Software as a service, mostly point solutions. These were tools to help people get work done more quickly. So I'll give you an example. In finance and insurance, a lot of the workflows involve lots of documents. And so you had basically OCR products, intelligent document processing, which might have used OCR or computer vision models, maybe some NLP models. But they were basically parsing documents, doing document classification, data extraction. And they would basically stop there, right? Even robotic process automation would stop there. They weren't able to do much more beyond that. And I think with AI agents, what you're able to do is, yes, you're able to take in documents that come in, you're able to read in the documents or do document classification, data extraction, but then you're able to go and determine what the next set of actions should be and even take those next set of actions. So a good example, like, we work in finance, we look at lending, like mortgages as an example, right? And mortgages come in, you want to have the AI agent not only read in the documents, but then verify, do you have the full set of documents that you need? Should this be an opportunity that we actually proceed with, or should we automatically decline that and let the borrower know, hey, this is not a good fit for what we do. Let's just automatically send you an email saying, hey, this is not going to work. And if it is going to work and it's a hot opportunity, then the goal for the AI agent is to go and populate the fields in the loan origination system that the loan officer needs to read in information from. So it's going in into the application layer, changing and amending the entries for this application that came in, and then sending an email or Slack, a notification to the loan officer saying, hey, look, great opportunity has come in. I've already evaluated this on my end. I've filled in the details in the web application, the loan origination software, and it's ready for you to review. And so you could think of this as like, it's almost like a junior analyst taking the first swath of work, doing it in the background behind the scenes, and then paying the more senior member of the team to go review. That is massively unlocking in terms of value.
But are they maybe, like, do they, are people like keen to trust to trust startups with those core workflows, because it's very important. We're talking about like approving a loan that might change someone else's life. And there are a lot of things at stake. So are people like keen to delegate this part?
So I think you said a really important thing there, which is the word trust, right? I think there are plenty of AI applications, particularly in consumer land, where you can just go wing it. Like you could just go see what the software or application is, like vibe coding, right? Like particularly if you're doing vibe coding on a net new build, it's not touching production software. You can just run amok, right? Just go test it, try it, whatever it might be. There are plenty of AI applications where if it fails, it's not going to have huge consequences. The type of work we do does have huge consequences. So trust is paramount. And I think trust happens on a couple of layers. First, to sell into finance and insurance, you need to have trust from a people perspective. So we as a company need to build a lot of trust and build a lot of good relationships with the stakeholders at banks and carriers, as an example. So there's a human to human trust layer. Like, do I trust you as a company to go and not screw up, right? To go in and do important work. The other type of trust is, do I trust the AI to do something that is going to affect people's financial lives? And around that, there's a lot of important work that needs to get done, which is, can you, in a sandboxed way, start training AI that you can then shadow, right? So human in the loop reviews to see that the AI is doing the things in the same way that a human loan officer or a human underwriter would do. And if you cannot gain trust through that sandboxed environment and kind of see that for yourself and see, like, what did the AI look at? What did it consider? How did it make decisions? What decisions did it make? Why did it make those decisions? If you can't trace your way through, you're never going to be able to trust this in a production setting. But that's exactly what multimodal does, right? We build these AI agents in a safe manner to develop trust. And then when there is enough trust and confidence that this is working well, we then turn the lights on for a production setting.
What do you mean by a safe manner? Because right now with finance, like finance insurance, which are the industries you're most tackling, like really hard to automate because there's pretty complex tasks. So do you train, what data do you take to train the models and the agents? Because it's basically large language models behind them that are learning from, let's say, how do you set up your prompt and where do you take the data? Like, how do you know that if the data is, like, let's say, unbiased or secure to train a model on?
Yeah, it's a great question. So I think the first thing is we have a sandboxed environment with every customer. And I think prompting is a very crude art form. Prompting can get you only so far. Prompting can demo well, but isn't going to be viable in a production setting. So the first thing we do is we try to get the existing documentation at the lender, for example, down on paper, right? So they have, for example, underwriting guidelines, in basically handbooks for loan officers. We try to get that on paper. We try to see if that's accurate. If it's not accurate, we'll work with the customer to get it to be more accurate, because that playbook, that documentation is what we train the AI on. So having that well-documented is really important. The next thing we do is we train the AI agents on historical opportunities. So think of this as like more context engineering on historical information, because those are examples that the AI can turn to do its work better, right? So it might still be in the context window. You could think of it as like prompting it with examples, you know, what is known as in-context learning. But that is materially going to be better than if you just like prompted with no examples, right? So having examples is really valuable. So we do this all in a sandboxed way where it's not going to affect their production systems. So they could go and see how the AI would decide on a net new application that just came in. They could see the document classification, the data extraction, the set of decisions and reasoning that the AI did. So you could trace your way through it. But that means that it's safer than if they did it on real production data. So once you build trust, and you feel safe around the outcomes and the use of data and such, then what we do is we move that proof of value into a production setting where we do the integrations so that real production data gets piped in. And we do it in a way that preserves information security. So most of the time for our customers, we're deploying our software platform in their environment. So all their sensitive data still stays in their walls. It's another part of information security that's really, really important to the customer.
Interesting. If you had to maybe start over building an agent on a specific niche, let's say in finance or insurance, What would you do to develop like a lasting moat in an industry or the niche? You could take finance, insurance, or any, let's say, other industry, could be healthcare or other, but what would you do? What would be the steps to follow to just be sure that you're targeting the right problem and you're targeting it right to develop like a real, let's say, barrier on your competition on the market and make sure that you are like, you have a tech that has an advantage over other people?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think building a durable moat, especially today, given the fluidity around like the disruption that AI is bringing, is very hard, right? So one of the biggest moats that you could build is product velocity. So can you build product very quickly to go take advantage of everything that's coming down from the foundation model labs, as an example, to introduce incredible solutions for your customer, right? So figuring out what problem to solve, narrowing in on how can you then take the latest and greatest from foundation models and then build solutions to solve that problem. That's like one great thing you could do, but you can't just build it once and then kind of sit on your hands, right? Like you have to have incredible product velocity. So that's the number one thing that I would index on, finding and building a team that can exercise product velocity. The second thing I think that you could build a moat on is basically the trust that you build with your customer base and the go-to-market motion, because there are what are called more efficient ways to get into accounts, to get into RFPs, to go and vie for these opportunities. And if you do a great job of building those relationships end up being part of the moat that you build, because it's hard for a net new player to kind of build the same go-to-market motion, right? So go-to-market moat is really important. So I think the product velocity moat, the go-to-market moat through durable existing relationships built on trust and built on your brand, I would lean on those two first and foremost if I were to redo this. The third thing that I would mention is you have to be very careful about what types of products you want to build. Because if your product that you're building is just a feature or is just one or two iterations away from the foundation models kind of introducing it as part of what they do natively, you're out of business, right? So really think about what segment of the market is it very hard to build in, that the foundation models aren't just going to erode your kind of product and positioning, right? So that's also really important to consider.
Super, super interesting advice, very helpful. But now if we were to go back on multimodal and agent flow, can you maybe introduce our listeners agent flow, what it is, and how did you come up with the vision to build such a powerful agentic platform?
Yeah, I think our frame has been the following, is that the last 20 years of SaaS and point solutions are not the way forward, right? I think they've created a lot of broken data silos, integration problems. It's made it hard for customers to do procurement and renegotiate with the vendors. So when we started multimodal, we had a very platform-first view. And agent flow is a platform-first and foremost. It's not a point solution. You can go slot it into what otherwise would be point solutions. But today, the way we look at it is that a point solution of yesterday is one or two AI agents of today, right? And so you don't want to go and just do a point solution, because a point solution is just one or two AI agents. What you want to be is the machine, the platform that helps you build out different AI agents for your space. And so Agent Flow is a platform that helps us or our customers, depending on how they want to do it, build out AI agents to set up an agentic workflow that can tackle pretty complex workflows and processes like mortgage lending, auto lending, student lending, small business lending. And the goal here is that we could go from the very first leg of the process, like ingestion of applications, to doing triage, so document classification, data extraction, doing diligence, making decisions, and then finally generating the reports like loan documentation and quotes, right? So we go the full cycle of that journey all off of one platform by building out different agents. And I think that's been the frame. That's the frame that we've used all along. And our approach to building out agents has changed in the sense that in the past, they used to be using workflow builders. Like you could think of like a Zapier or Make.com or N8N. I think the workflow builders is a little clunky. So we've developed more modern ways of almost in some ways like vibe coding, but in this case, like through text interfaces, like vibing your way to automation, right? Creating an agentic workflow. So that's the future, where you can go and more quickly get the automation built out by telling the AI what thing you're trying to solve for, and then having it go in and set up that workflow for you. We've also built curated playbooks. So we have playbooks for, you know, mortgage lending, student lending, auto lending, small business lending, and the like. And so our customers can get to value very quickly, knowing that we've already built this and we've covered a lot of their boxes in terms of governance, trust, security, and the like.
Super interesting point about vibe coding. I've noticed a lot of startups like Genspark that are introducing interfaces that let you build agents just by describing and typing what you want. There are of course a lot of factors to consider when building such complex platform, like speed, design, or even compliance. So how do you decide what to prioritize first?
So I think you have to be clear on non-negotiables, so items that have to be done, right? So for us, it was like, we have to get governance done. We have to have really good stance on security. We have to go and have things like audit logs, execution logs, be able to have confidence scores, right? Be able to go and do evals, like look at precision recall around the agents, and provide our customers visibility into how these agents work. So you could do like chain of thought, you could walk your way through, you could see progress trackers around what the AI agents are doing behind the scenes, right? Because like, you don't want this to be a black box, not in this space. Like you just can't, like for compliance and regulatory reasons. So those are non-negotiables we had to build. I think the next big thing though was we wanted to lean on product design. Product design is really important. Like think of it this way, everyone has access to the same compute, the same storage, the same foundation models, right? The same hyperscalers. So everyone is kind of working off the same, like, same picks and shovels as everyone else. What really matters at the end of the day is then how do you design your product to make it easier to use all of these picks and shovels to get to a solution more quickly that solves the pain in a particular industry. So for us, it's like, okay, our lenders have this pain. How do we design a product experience that more quickly helps them have the solution that they need to solve the pain that they experience without getting bogged down in tooling layers and frameworks and different LLMs and how to go and do batch processing and how to go and optimize the infrastructure layer. Like they don't want to worry about that complexity, right? In most cases, the business teams want to get to solutions. So we built an entire product experience that is more solution oriented to solve the pain for the business teams.
And about, for example, the number of use cases you integrate, do you think it's better to start with like many different product use cases, or focus on one, narrowing it down, and make sure it works as best as possible?
Yeah, I think this is a very hard thing to navigate, because initially as a startup, you have some inclination as to what the best use cases will be, but you want to validate that, right? So you don't want to be so stubborn and say like, this is the one use case, I only care about this use case, I'm not going to do it. Unless you're building a point solution, in which case, yeah, it makes sense. You're building a point solution, it's narrowly focused on one use case, just go do that. But when you're a little bit more of a platform player like we are, you want to cast a little bit of a wider net and then feel where the pull is and then double down on where the pull is. So you end up with still like 1 to 3 use cases that you're going to really double or triple down, knowing that there might be a multitude of other use cases you could do with your team and build pods on and kind of get the go-to-market motion going. But you have to be much more focused given that you have a limited amount of resources in terms of time, attention, team size, right, capital. And so the constraints are very important. You have to be focused, choose a fewer set of use cases that are validated. And then over time, you could broaden out the number of use cases you tackle and truly build a multi-product platform experience.
How would you today convince, because AI agents basically built on a promise that you're getting return on investment for your client.
Yeah.
How would you convince a client that your agents are going to bring him return investments without him getting a free trial, let's say over a month or over 2 weeks, because you get infrastructure costs and that wouldn't be scalable doing so. So you need the clients to pay beforehand that you even show them the potential. So how do you scale on promises, and how do you sell and scale your sales and sales team over promises?
Yeah, so I think one thing is you can't just tell people like it's going to deliver X value. You need to be able to show it to them. So being able to kind of use your product to show value, like in demos, right? Or in quick, like proof of values to do, very, very important, right? You can't use existing client data, but you can create synthetic data to then demo on, right? That is very close to their use case. And that's exactly what we do. I think, you know, we have environments that have synthetic data that like have a full playbook built out for like a mortgage lender, right? And so we're able to very quickly show them how this would work for their type of lending. So it feels very calibrated. It feels very personalized. They could see it. They could, their eyes open up around the value that this could create. And so I think that helps build a lot of trust because you're a player that can show as opposed to just tell. That's very important. Now, I think because this technology is so new, most customers will still want some sort of proof of value on their own data. And there, I think you have to be very clear around the scale and size and scope of that proof of value. But from our perspective, we try to reduce the amount of people effort that it takes for a use case by 50% as quickly as possible. In some cases, that might be a 2-week long proof of value. In some cases, it might be as long as 6 weeks, right? But getting to a demonstrable return, like 50% reduction in effort required, that is something that you can track and point to as a KPI for success.
How do you measure it? That it's actually, that you've actually replaced half of their workforce. How do you measure it?
So we benchmark it internally. So we have a team that says, like, based on if we had to do this manually or using existing software that the customer uses, here's how many hours it would take or how many minutes it would take on a small batch. And then we basically turn multimodal agents on and say, okay, well, let's do the same work with multimodal agents and simulate like how long it takes and the accuracy of the results and such. And we're able to just then prepare a report that shows A versus B. And of course, we ask the customer, what tools are you using? Are you using any automation software, right? Because we want to mimic their environment, but that ends up being the baseline, like scenario A, their present scenario. And scenario B is basically with multimodal. And so we're able to kind of show that before and after and then prepare a report to go in and basically highlight the value that's been created.
Okay. Can you maybe walk us through a real example of that and how you go from like the pilot and demo to the production and how do you make sure that this phase goes well and you actually convert the client and there's no churn on it?
Yeah. So first, we do a lot of discovery. We qualify our customer intensely because we're a startup. We don't want to waste our time on opportunities that aren't real, right? It's very, very important in terms of, as I said earlier, focus, right? So we do that qualification through discovery. And then we try to identify a use case that is part of the core work we do. And we create constraints around it, which is like, okay, let's do a proof of value. Right. So a good example is like, let's do a proof of value in small business lending, right? So SBA lending in the US, small business lending. And we know the documents that are present there. We know the things that need to get parsed. We know the types of decisions that need to get made around having certain financial ratios that are present to be able to make a lending decision. So we go to customer and say, hey, look, let's do small business lending. We know that's a core need for you. We're going to run it on your data. It could be redacted data or it could be kind of historical data that's non-redacted, but we'll do it on your data. And we're going to do all the steps that you normally need to do, like document classification, data extraction. And then based on the guidelines that you send us, we're going to have the AI make the n number of decisions with explanations as to those decisions. So we set up the environment, we run their documents through, we show the outputs of the AI agents, and we do that in a, call it 2 weeks long setting generally. And before we even show the results to the customer, we validate the results showing how much time would it take if we were to do this manually, and then how much time would it take with multimodal. So then we are able to not only present them the environment to test on their own, but we say, look, we've already done some internal evaluation of this. We think that this is like about the right reduction in effort that you'll experience. Go and validate that for yourself. And so at the end of the proof of value, we want the customer to nod their head and say, yes, we agree that this is the value that can be created. And then what we do there, and we're doing this alongside doing the proof value, is we try to figure out all the things that need to happen for this to move into a production setting, right? That's sort of how we frame it here.
And have you encountered any objections from the client's perspective? And if so, like, what is your approach to dealing with those objections?
Yeah, the common objections, and I think we've gotten better around this, is like, do we want to, like, you guys are great. We love what you're doing, but you know, we're still debating whether we want to buy or build, right? And I think that's changing because I think people realize just how hard it is to build internally. Because you're not just building it once. Who's going to do the maintenance? Who's going to think through information security, governance, trust, all of these things that need to get done, particularly if you have not one use case, but many use cases. Most companies, even the Fortune 500, aren't set up to build truly net new product in that way, right? And so I think they're realizing that. And I think that's kind of changed the nature of the conversations. It's like, okay, we're not going to build. We're going to like partner with startups like yours to build more quickly, because there's plenty of building on top of what you have that we'll need to do to make it work for our enterprise use case. So I think that's one big objection, and that's one we always have to work through. The other one is like, okay, well, we're testing out 8 different vendors and we don't know what KPIs matter to us. We're still kind of winging it. And so we're just doing like a learning exercise, a discovery exercise. I think generally there, we used to do a lot of those, and basically in some cases, like we would be number one or number two in that RFP, but then it wouldn't progress, right? It wouldn't progress because the customer just didn't have enough intent around buying. So they didn't buy for anyone. They were just using it to kind of learn. And I get it. Like, customers are buying the software for the first time. They need to learn before they kind of understand like how to even think about buying. But we're trying to dissuade like those opportunities as much as possible internally, because the intent just isn't there, right? And we'll do like quick demonstrations of value, but doing a full-blown proof of value doesn't make sense, because the odds of that converting into a production deal are pretty slim to begin with.
You mentioned, for example, eight vendors. So this ties back to the point that the competition is huge.
Yeah.
There are many players out there who are trying to win the market. What is your strategy around differentiating yourself and not being the 10th agentic AI platform that will do the same?
Yeah. Well, yeah, I think it's a really great question, because I think finance and insurance are both very networked spaces. So if you do a great job of getting in to like marquee logos, then you could grow very well, because there's good word of mouth that happens. But the question is, if there are not just tens, but 1,000 startups that sound or look similar, how do you kind of stand apart from the pack? So for us, a couple of things. One is like, doing direct sales is important, and we do a lot of that. But leveraging your existing network to find like insider tracks to get into accounts helps in the early days. And like founder-led sales, for example, is a huge part of how we've won in the early days. But in the longer run, and this is like a huge part of how we do it today, is the one-to-many. You want to find the channel partners that have those pre-existing relationships, like consulting firms, systems integrators, workbenches that you could integrate and then partner with, because they are easier in some ways to win over, right? If you have the right product and they're testing out the products and such. And then if you win them over, it's not just winning one account. You could win dozens or hundreds of accounts through them. And so the channel partnership way is really important. We're leaning very heavily into that. It's something that UiPath, for example, in robotics process automation did very well, as they scaled very nicely in 2018 and 2019 as an example. So that's a huge part of our kind of way to win in the market. But it is very hard. Like, I think that's just the nature. Like, this space is very competitive. There is a lot at stake in terms of what the winner is going to win a lot, right? There's like so much market value to win on. And so that's exactly the game that we're playing in. We're just trying to find, in some ways, like call it unfair ways to go and win, right? Like, give us a huge advantage in terms of getting into the right accounts. So we're doing as much of that as possible.
Right? USK content doing so, or was it strategy? Because with low budget, I've seen you haven't raised yet. Have you raised money on Multimodal?
We've raised a very small round, so minimally dilutive, because I think our frame has been, let's go and build really great product, get revenue going, let revenue kind of fund our operations until we feel like we have a lot of things that have been tested and been like battle hardened to go and spend a lot of capital on. So I think we're getting to that juncture where we want to raise massive amounts of capital to scale up this motion. But in the early days, I almost feel like too much capital too soon can be bad for your company. Because now all of a sudden you have a lot of capital, you end up spending a lot of it very quickly, and you just have a lot of things you're testing and trying and experimenting, and you lose focus, right? So one of the things we wanted to do was remain hyper-focused. It really test out in a smaller environment, like all the things we wanted to test out and build product in. And then once we have a lot of things that are working well, then we have like a coming of age moment, right? And we use a lot of capital to scale up a pre-existing motion that's working well.
But aren't you scared that the other competitors are doing so much faster speed, and that if there is a lot of capital, like there's so much money on the market? Like, if you look at just like another space, just like the vibe coding space, like everyone, if they just thought of doing small, they would lose. Maybe, I don't know, because we've seen like, even OpenAI with Codex, they can't compete with like Cursor and the others. The first movers have the competitive advantage. So why wouldn't you like be in that like strategy of like, and like if you look at also like Decagon, and other like agents on support and other companies. They maybe didn't spend too much. They probably spent very few time on that very 0-1 part and scaled too fast. But still, it's paying off, and all those companies are making a huge amount of revenue, and users seem like happy.
Yeah. So it's a very good and fair point. And I think that is the kind of the consideration to make, right? So a couple of things. I think the vibe coding space is an example, and it's oriented around consumers or prosumers. So like a bottom-up motion. Same thing with Cursor, same thing with Lovable and Replit and, you know, all these players, right? And so when it's a motion like that, when it's consumer or prosumer or devs, I think you want to grab market share as quickly as possible and spend massive amounts of capital and subsidize your business with the capital you raise. And I think you absolutely have to spend like crazy to go and win those markets. I think in the market that we're selling into, like think about this as like enterprise sales. Enterprise sales happens very slowly. It's very relationship driven. It's very trust driven. You can't like spend massive amounts of capital and like use that capital to win necessarily, right? It does help. It means you have more account executives, you have a bigger marketing budget and all of those things, but it doesn't have the same what I call conditions that you would have in a prosumer or consumer type of landscape in a enterprise to enterprise sales motion. So I think for us, it's now a bigger consideration than it was when we first started. So like if you think about 2023, agents were so new, people didn't even hear about them. Like they didn't know if that was right for them. It was like the market awareness isn't even there. The market isn't even there for agents 2 years ago. Now that the market's heating up, I think you're right. I think now is more of a time to like really seriously think about raise much more amounts of capital to market and build brand and whatnot. But I will say, like, if you raise crazy amounts of dollars, you're not going to necessarily have a very, very easy time growing, because enterprise sales just takes time, right? You like got to do a lot of things right. And so I think because of that, the same playbook that you would use to build a vibe coding application doesn't necessarily apply for enterprise sales.
But companies like Decagon, they're doing enterprise sales, but still scaling crazy fast. Don't you think it's easier like to maybe reverse engineer that 0-1 part with capital, and they're doing so the hard way and getting eaten by competition and like arriving like 6 months too late where the competition already has a big share of the market?
Yeah, I think that's fair. And I think customer support, I think it was kind of more one of the faster moving use cases to kind of get off the plate, right? So like Sierra, Decagon and others, right, taking advantage of that. I think that that's a very good example of like, hey, this is enterprise sale, and being the first one in means that the second one doesn't have a chance of getting in at all. Maybe they're blocked entirely. And so the first one to get in kind of wins.
Yeah.
And I think a good example could also be like the legal market. Like I think Harvey and Legora as an example, like the legal AI firms, they have such a huge advantage that, and at some point, like if you're just too late to compete with Harvey or Legora in terms of getting in, you're blocked out, right? So that's something we'll have to kind of very seriously take into consideration around when we raise and how we raise, right? I don't think you've quite seen that in finance and insurance just yet, but I think you're right. Like in the next year or two, unless you spend like crazy, the market may be closed out to the next player, right? Because like getting the first one in and doing a great job means that the second mover has a harder time kind of winning that market.
That's super interesting. But now moving on to maybe the content part, the content strategy. I know you are a leading voice in AI. You have written multiple books, have a podcast called Pioneers, which I encourage our listeners to listen to. And you also have a Substack and many other channels. So for our listeners who, you know, like are curious about creating content, what would be your advice? And especially, you know, do you think, you know, they should master one channel before diving into another channel, or should they go all in and like have a podcast, a Substack or and whatnot?
Yeah, I think my advice is to remain very focused. Start with one channel, get really good at it. Find your voice. Like finding your voice is hard. It's like designing a product or designing a brand, or like getting your voice that's authentic, that resonates with the audience you're trying to target, and is authentic to you. Like it reflects your personality. Very, very important. But ultimately, this is an attention economy, right? So building a B2B startup, even though we're not a consumer, we're in a B2B enterprise motion, you want to build a brand. That brand really does matter. That means you need to be on multiple channels, and each channel operates differently. Like I'll say, like X operates very differently than LinkedIn. And these channels also change every 6 months or a year, right? You have a lot of AI slop, a lot of AI content generation for good and bad. And it's like, how do you kind of, now that there's so much content, how do you stand apart from that? The tactics change. Like it used to be more text, and now it's more oriented around video content and such. And podcasts, I think, are really having a moment, but now there's so many podcasts that it's not differentiated to have a podcast. You have to really find like how to grow and scale that podcast as a form of your brand. But I think being multi-channel is ultimately the end state that almost all brands need to get to. But you need to find one or two channels that really work before you kind of move into that multi-channel view. And I would think of this as like a multi-year journey, right? Like no one builds incredible content engine in 3 to 6 months. It's rare. Like some people do, and great for them. But for most, it takes time to kind of build it right. And consistency is also a huge part of this.
Yeah, consistency is key, especially in content. But like now, just kidding, we need to wrap up a bit. So we only have like a couple of minutes left. What are you most excited about building next with multi-model? Is it like new products, new verticals, new geographies, new target markets? What's the next step for you?
The biggest thing that I'm excited by is redesigning the product experience for business operators. So today, agentic AI is for technologists, it's for devs. It's hard to understand, it's hard to use. I think that the horizontal workflow builders like an N8N, Make.com, Zapier, the ones that are doing automation more broadly, maybe leveraging some of agentic AI, they're clunky, they're hard to use. And I think what we've done is like we've taken the paradigm around product experiences around vibe coding, right? So think like Lovable, which allows you to kind of basically vibe code your way to a web application, both front end and back end. We're taking that same paradigm and we're applying it to agentic automation. So how do you kind of vibe your way to doing automation for lending as an example, or for insurance underwriting? So it's still oriented towards a business operator. It's still in a highly regulated space on a very complex workflow, but it should be far easier for you to start to get to value through the product experience. And if we do that, we'll unlock a lot of demand among this segment. And we see the demand, but it's frankly way too hard for our customers to get value, especially if they don't have IT and engineering teams that can support them. So we're trying to target business operators that can vibe their way to getting to automation more quickly, at least seeing value and building a business case for their entire org to then support them in doing the integrations and such to land agentic AI into what they do. So that's a huge part of our story, will be a huge part of our story heading into next year.
But do you think most agentic startups will shift towards an interface that looks like Lovable in the future?
Yeah, our worldview is like that prompt box, the text box that you could kind of go and give intent and then have that intent be converted into something useful, right? That's here to stay. But it will be far more powerful than having a prompt box where you ask a question and you just get an answer. Right? That's where we've started. That's where we are today. I think what you'll see instead is in the prompt box, you give intent. And because the product behind the scenes is built for your vertical and knows the types of use cases, it's able to infer a lot of things and leverage, hopefully, connectors and integrations and data partners to go and do materially more amounts of work. So just like how an AI agent would code its way and plan and code its way to getting you to full value, more complete value, we see that as being a paradigm in agentic automation. And that's the world that we're building. That's like what we think is going to be the big bold bet for 2026.
That's all we hope for you. Now, last questions before we wrap up this episode. Who else do you think we should interview in the space? Enterprise AI, building AI agents, and why on the 0-1 podcast, someone that's made it to from the 0-1 part?
Yeah, so it's a great question. So I think speaking to players that have started to get good motions in finance and insurance to date that have seen maybe a leg of the journey already. For example, like the founder of Hebbia, who would be a great example. I think they were early on in finance, particularly around search and indexing data. I think those would be incredible. You know, I think looking at a company like Norma AI that does regulatory compliance, that has had also wins in finance and insurance, also really, really great segment. So those are ones from my vertical that are adjacent that are, I think, would be really meaningful, because now they're at the scale-up motion, right? And seeing kind of how they got from 0-1 and beyond, I think would be really meaningful.
Like ping pong. So what's the lesson you learned the hard way as a founder and CEO?
how important it is to kind of get the customer feedback on product that you build. You don't want to be building in a vacuum. You want to be building for the customer.
One startup you're quietly excited about right now.
That's a tough one, but I think Replit. I think Replit has shown that vibe coding is here to stay. It can be done in production. So I'm looking at them very, very closely.
The Agent 3 and Replit, yeah. What's the most underrated founder skill that doesn't get discussed enough?
Building relationships with would-be employees. It's very important. Talent is the number one thing that makes a company. So being able to recruit new talent is very, very important.
Favorite tool, app, or framework that you are using daily?
Claude Code. It's a mainstay. I'm addicted to it. Super valuable. Can't recommend it more.
Completely agree.
What book, podcast, or thinker shapes your approach to AI and automation?
I think 0 to 1, like the actual book, I think is really important. The concept of building kind of a monopoly in what you do, right? Really, really important. And I think it borrows on themes of like playing in a blue ocean versus a red ocean. So you want to find a way to not have to fight competition to build a great business.
Great book. We have a contract with a partnership with Peter Thiel on this podcast about distribution rights. So I'm sure our audience will like it. And maybe last question, if you could give advice to a 20-year-old founder in 2025, what will it be?
Enjoy the journey. I mean, I think all the ups and downs shape you personally and professionally, but it's a thing that you'll remember. So, you know, try not to like be anxious around things that ultimately you'll look back at and learn from either way. So just enjoy the ride.
Don't beat yourself too hard. It's a good question, good advice, especially for founders that are stressed about making ends meet at the beginning. It's a long and tough journey. So yeah, we should all enjoy it, at least try to see the bright side. So thank you so much. And yeah, hopefully we can grab a coffee soon in New York.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me. Really enjoyed the podcast.
That's it for this episode of 0 to 1. If this gave you an idea, an edge, or the courage to build, send it to your friend, founder, or your team. Follow us, subscribe, and drop us a DM if there's someone you want to hear next. Until then, keep building, keep shipping, and go from 0 to 1.